Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. January is the height of deer season here in Sportsman's Paradise. Hunter Scott Gibert joins us with Tales from the Woods. Then we flip the coin to examine the vegan life with chefs John Morales and O'Shea Cleveland of the new pop-up restaurant, Oh Vegasm. We're stirring up controversy and serving it with a Cumberland sauce on this week's Louisiana Eats. Louisiana native Scott Gibert has been tracking the deliciously edible wild game of our state for over 40 years. As this year's deer season comes to a close, Scott is here with some wild tales from the woods. Scott, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you.
I want to know right off the bat, how do you prepare for a hunt?
Oh, prepare for a hunt? Well, you got to get in the woods early. Depending on what kind of hunt it is, the season right before deer season, let's say, I try and get in the woods and find some sign, maybe put some cameras up, see where the deer are hanging out at what time of the day, check for areas where they've been bedding down, and hopefully set stands up in the right places to where when the hunting season opens that you are able to be able to take a good deer.
Explain to me about the camera thing, because it sounds like, you know, James Bond hunting. Where are you monitoring these cameras from?
Become very sophisticated nowadays. You put chips in them, they have batteries in them, they detect motion, they take pictures at night with infrared. In the off season, some people put a lick out that the animal wants to come and get salt off of or minerals off of. Or you just find a crossing where you know they're going to cross. They strap to trees. Some of these cameras are so sophisticated, you can they can transmit to you like a cell phone does, and you don't even have to go out there and see them. But most people go out, pull the chip out of their camera, throw it in their laptop, and see what was where at what time.
Scott, you've been hunting, I suppose, just about as long as you can remember, huh?
Yeah. You know, I first started hunting. My parents owned some property in Bush, Louisiana. I was, I guess, maybe 8 or 9. My father would, I'd tell him I'm going squirrel hunting in the morning, and I'd leave the house with my Lefevre 410 crack barrel shotgun, and I was only allowed to hunt around the stock pond. We had a 2-acre stock pond by the house, but we had these fox squirrels there. And they're smart, and so I'd go out and find a tree and sit underneath the tree and just call, and then if I heard a squirrel, I'd try and get under that tree and just wait. And as the story goes, you know, we were never allowed to shoot anything that we wouldn't eat. I just remember the time my father sent me out and put me under a tree, and one of these huge redhead woodpeckers got in that tree and just started working it. And worked it and worked it, worked it, till I just got so tired of hearing him, I turned around and I shot him. Yeah, and I went home, my dad's sitting on the front porch drinking his coffee. He says, "How'd you do?" I said, "Well, I kind of fibbed. I said, I missed him, Dad." He said, "Well, you missed him. Well, you sure hit that red-headed woodpecker. You better go pick him up because you're going to eat him."
That's a very good lesson.
Was it a lesson? If you ever eaten dental floss, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Well, tell me about your most exciting kill of the year.
Well, that will have to be the most recent one. I recently shot a buck. He was the biggest I've ever even seen in the woods. So for the Christmas holidays, I took my youngest son, Jonathan, and myself to our hunting camp up in Pinckneyville, Mississippi. Before that week, I'd spent several weeks in the woods, you know, setting up, getting stands ready, and talking to all the professional hunters, the ones that are there all the time, and getting tips of where to go and what to do. And, of course, you got to pry these secrets out of them. So we hunted a solid week from a Monday through New Year's Eve. And so the very last hunt I had, one of the members of the camp who has been bow hunting all year, they're in the woods a lot earlier than I am, and they've got cameras set up, and they know where to look. And he was hunting this one buck pretty much of the year, and this was my last hunt, New Year's Eve morning. he said, look, I'm going to put some dogs out up by this pasture here. I want you to go in the woods about 200 yards. Just get where you can see good. Just set up and stay there. He didn't give me any details other than to do that, but I knew it was a good piece of advice.
It was a good tip.
Yes, a good tip. Absolutely. You know, so you get out there at daybreak, and I set up, and I did exactly what he said, and I saw lots of sign. There were fantastic rubs everywhere and scrapes on the ground, and you could just tell I was in the wonderland of the places to be. So I put about 3 hours into that area, and then kind of got bored and knew the hunt was coming to an end. So around 10 o'clock in the morning, we start moving out of the woods and go eat lunch. So I'm walking. Maybe the road's 400 yards long,
uh-huh.
And about 100 yards ahead of me, I see this huge buck cross the road. And I realize he's heading into an area I'd just come out of 30 minutes ago, which is a bottom. And I ran as fast as I could to the edge of the bottom and looked down into the bottom. And about 75 yards away, a doe goes scrambling up the hill, which tells me he's chasing her.
Uh-huh.
So we're in the beginning of the rut. The rut is on. Well, these big bucks, when the rut comes in, they're not using their head too good. That deer didn't even see me, and normally he'd have known I was there long before I knew he was there. So I pulled my gun up, followed the doe, and realized the buck was behind him. Here comes the buck. I'm going to say 50 to 75 yard shot, and he's running up a hill, so I shot him in a good kill spot.
Mm-hmm.
And he fell. As I'm getting my marbles together, I'm so excited. I'm shaking. I've never killed a deer this big. I'm just so excited. You know, this is going to be the one I hang on the wall. And I start walking towards him, and all of a sudden I see him again up on top of the other ridge across the way, running like crazy. So I take another shot at him, and I miss. Only to realize that wasn't the only buck chasing this doe.
Oh.
They were chasing the same girl, and may the best man win, I guess.
And so you fixed the contest for him,
Well,
huh?
I think there was a smile on that last buck's face when he ran off.
Did he wink at you?
Kind of bit, yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, I'd like you to explain also, because, you know, this sounds sort of, you know, like, oh, you're out there killing these animals, and there's a reason for all this. There's a management method. Would you talk to us about that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the property we hunt on is a leased piece of property. It's managed by the state. They come in and they do a head count on the deer. How they actually do it, I'm not quite sure. But I do know that they tell us every year you need to take so many does. And this year, I think it's 60 does that we need to, you know, harvest from the fields. And there's regulations on how many bucks you can kill and how many does. And they do it for reasons. The reasons are because they get different diseases if they're overpopulated. And, you know, it's healthy for the wildlife to manage them properly.
Well, that's an awful lot of meat. What do you do with all that meat?
This deer I took in, and being an older deer like he is, the meat's pretty tough. So you take the filet mignon out of the deer and you save that and cook it in several different special ways. If it were a doe, you'd save the rumps, the hindquarters, and you make roasts out of them.
Mm.
And you cook them just like you cook any other roast. Of course, there's a million recipes out there, which are wonderful. And as far as the buck goes, you grind that meat up. You make ground meat out of him. You can mix it with pork to make hamburgers. You can make spaghettis, chilies, whatever you cook with any kind of ground meat. And secondly, you know, venison is dry. And if you overcook it just a little bit too much, then you're not going to be happy with it. So, yeah, I make sausage. I take about 50% of the meat that I grind up, and I make it into sausage. But the rest of it, either keep it as ground meat or cube it to put in stews or make it into roasts.
It's a delicious flavor. Thank you so much for coming to share all of these wild tales from the woods.
Thank you for having me, Poppy.
Louisiana hunter Scott Gibert. All the guys are here. We drink the cards and shoot the bull. We never shoot no deer. The only time we leave the camp is when we go for beer. Second week of deer camp is the greatest time of year. For hundreds of years, Cumberland sauce has been the traditional accompaniment for game. Said to have originated in Hanover, Germany, and named for the Duke of Cumberland, this sweet, tart elixir, rarely seen today, can be found on New Orleans restaurant menus dating back to the 1870s. Currant jelly is the main component in most Cumberland sauce recipes, but when hunter Scott Gibert gifted me with a jar of John Campbell's muscadine jelly from the R. Cole Hunting Club, I decided it was the perfect ingredient for concocting a local version of Cumberland sauce. Scott describes Mr. John Campbell, the Hunt Club's manager, as a true Southern gentleman who maintains great discipline and order at the hunting camp. He also makes a mean muscadine jelly with a very tart bite that's perfect with venison. I simmered the jelly together with port wine, dry ginger, the juice and zest of Louisiana navel oranges and Meyer lemons, and then whisked in Creole mustard, Zatarain's, of course, and hot sauce. I think even the Duke of Cumberland would approve of this new spicy version of his sauce. For a copy of the recipe and a treasure trove of other culinary inspiration, visit our website, wwno.org, where you can also easily email us your questions and comments. This is Louisiana Eats. Now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, on what date is king cake consumption traditionally supposed to commence, is January 6th. The Feast of the Epiphany, also known as King's Day. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
This week's winner has been submitting answers for many, many weeks now, and her commitment to the quiz is finally going to pay off. Congratulations to you, Judith Brown of Metairie, Louisiana. You're this week's culinary contest winner. Thanks to everyone out there who participated, and please visit us online for your chance to win.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the name of the Mississippi beach town whose fortunes were changed by the popularity of a radish? Email your answers to LouisianaEats at wwno.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what is the name of the Mississippi beach town whose fortunes were changed by the popularity of a radish? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to LouisianaEats at wwno.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. British native Donald Watson was the father of the vegan movement. In 1944, he coined the term and founded the Vegan Society to promote an end to man's exploitation of animals. Today, there are an estimated 1 million Americans living a vegan lifestyle. John Morales and O'Shea Cleveland are working to make vegan life a little more delicious in Louisiana at their new pop-up restaurant endeavor, O Vegasm. John and O'Shea, thanks for joining us on Louisiana
Eats. Thank you for having us.
So how did you all come to adapt the vegan diet?
I was complete meat eater, and I had just seen the atrocious treatment of animals through a magazine. It just changed me right there upon the spot.
And same for me. I had, you know, I grew up and my number one thing that I would order at a restaurant was a hamburger and fries because it's, you know, the standard typical American cuisine. And I read a book that really kind of talked about what vegan was and why, you know, and also how. And it just it really hit me. And I was very interested in trying to pursue the lifestyle. So my fiance and I decided to give it a shot really recently, earlier this year. And we love it.
In vegan cooking, what are your key protein sources?
Well, we have many protein sources. As a vegan, plant-based protein, you can get protein from nuts, seeds, legumes, whole grains.
Split peas, lentils.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. There's many, many sources of plant-based protein. So, and you don't have any of the negative aspects that you get from animal-based protein when you eat plant-based protein. So.
Well, I was wondering if you all could describe for us some of your favorite dishes. What is it you all like to cook and eat vegan style?
Vegan style? I really like jambalaya.
And how do you do that?
You know, it's really simple. I just use veg stock, and I make my own. It's kind of like an andouille, but it's made out of wheat gluten and some seasonings, and it's really good.
Well, I think the misconception with, you know, meat alternatives is that it's a fake product. You know, people say, I don't want to eat fake meat. It's fake. It's artificial. The truth of the matter is we use whole plant-based ingredients, and we make our, like, seitan sausage, for example, from scratch. We use wheat gluten, which is the protein from wheat. We use things like nutritional yeast, which is extremely healthy, loaded with vitamins. We use garbanzo bean flour, which comes from chickpeas. And so we're using these ingredients that are very, you know, much healthier than the extremely processed and almost fake element that has become meat these days, you know. So it's really interesting. I think our food is much less processed, much less fake than what you're actually getting when you buy a package of bacon.
Start from scratch, okay? Let's say that you were going to whip up some meatless andouille.
Okay. Well, you just get some wheat gluten, get some chickpea flour, and get some nutritional yeast and some seasonings. I usually put some soy sauce and some liquid smoke. And I also use Chef Paul Prudhomme's Poultry Magic, too.
Does it go into a casing?
No. Okay. No, you just roll it up. You can roll it up into like the shape of like sausage, or you can roll it up into the shape of like a meatloaf, and you put it up in aluminum foil and you can steam it or you can bake it.
Well, that is so cool.
And the great thing about it is, especially I think a lot of people are very sensitive to texture in food, it has an excellent texture, especially the way John makes it. It really has a fantastic texture. It feels like you're eating meat, and then you can make it taste however you want. So it can mimic things like chicken. It can mimic anything depending on how you season it and texture it.
Right, and there's
wonderful
vegetarian broth.
Yes.
And beef broth and stuff like that you can also use to give it that extra kick if you really want to go that far.
I see.
Yeah, this was my first vegan Thanksgiving, and I wanted that traditional stuffing with that, like, chicken flavor, but I was not going to use chicken broth. And we added a little chicken flavor to veggie broth, and it tasted exactly like it, and it was fantastic.
Well, I know one of the things that is very popular on the Ovegasm menu is your mac and cheese.
Okay.
How do you do that with no dairy?
Use cashews.
And you can cashews?
Use like any, yeah, you can use like any tree nut or even like any seed that you would want to. And you can make cheeses, you can make milks. You can use macadamia nuts, pecans, cashews. It's really just whatever, you know, you're into.
Is it hard to acquire the raw ingredients for this?
No.
No.
The way I do it, you would just soak the cashews up overnight. And you put it up in a blender, and you blend it up, and you can put like a pretty good amount of nutritional yeast up in there to give it kind of like a cheesy flavor.
And it's also loaded with B vitamins, so it's very healthy. You're getting all the healthy fats from the raw cashews, and you can get raw cashews anywhere. You can get them at the bulk section in Whole Foods. You can probably get them at Sam's Club. They're not a difficult item to procure. And also, again, you can get many different types of raw nuts, macadamia nuts, almonds. You know, people buy almond milk. They start and with this, you know, similar process.
Sunflower seeds, you can do that too.
So, John, I know you have a sort of semi-traditional cooking background because, for instance, you worked with Paul Prudhomme at K. Paul's
yeah.
and some other New Orleans restaurants. But you all are both essentially self-taught when it comes to cooking. Is that correct?
Definitely. Yeah.
So how did you acquire this cooking methodology? Where does someone start to teach themselves how to do this?
Oh, I really looked at it through the internet. And I found a lot of good ways to do things. Like, you know, you start out doing stuff like raw milk, pecan milk or something like that. And then you just take it from there. I mean, there's really good cookbooks out there, too, that you can get into and you can find out a lot.
I think we are successful and we know how to do what we do because of all the very innovative, creative vegans that came before us who really gave us a lot of information, a lot of tools, a lot of their trial and error to kind of help us start. And that was a huge resource for us. There's really a lot of information out there that helped us along the way.
Well, one of the things I really wanted to talk about was I understand here in New Orleans, people are actually getting together for vegan cocktails. What's the vegan cocktail event like?
Well, there's this wonderful vegan in town. Her name is Melissa Bastian, and she does something called vegan drinks. And we have provided the food for them several times. And it's a really great way for vegans to get together to kind of have a social evening to, you know, be able to get some drinks that you normally couldn't order because they generally have dairy or the non-vegan alcohol. And she, Melissa, is very, you know, she's very particular. She makes sure that what is serving is vegan. When, you know, it came to our attention that there was a non-vegan champagne being served, we made sure to make note of it. She let us know. But she creates a drink menu, brings all the ingredients that the bar might need, and she, you know, has the menu. She teaches the bartenders how to make the drinks. So it's really great. It makes it, it's just worry-free for all of the vegans who attend.
That's so cool. This is just such a fascinating topic, and I really appreciate you guys coming to talk with us
Absolutely.
About this on
sure.
Louisiana Eats. O'Shea Cleveland and John Morales of the new pop-up vegan restaurant, O'Vegasm. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we celebrate the 89th birthday of culinary icon, Leah Chase.
We would really not be here were it not for Leah Chase and her family, and the city of New Orleans would not be what it is. Dookie Chase's was the place that opened up its doors in the deepest part of the South during our most difficult times so that people could have communion and find a way to seek and to grab common ground.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Light Seekin Funeral Homes, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Cookin' Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.